Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Can They Do That? Right after this. You know, Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history. This surveillance and electronic record-keeping of nearly every routine activity, from bank deposits to medical visits, has produced greater efficiency and security. But it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. Now, the federal government currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American. Now, that's according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget. And closer to home, our state and local governments use computers to keep their own files on us. In a study, for instance, conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government, found that that state, New York, and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems. Those systems contained 10,799 categories of information about New York residents. And every one of those systems contained between 2 and 10 million records. Now, all of this information about you is gained from 63 sources, and this information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how your government, your banks, your insurance companies, and industry is obtaining all of this information about you? What are their sources? How is it being stored? How is it retrieved? What do they want it for anyway? Well, knowing how this information is being gathered and what information is being stored and what information you want to keep personal and private actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, if you'd like more information about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. And ask for our free general law CD package while you're at it. And let me tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and private as you want to be. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and ask for one right now. The number, again, is 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, why don't you go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. All right, can they do that? We've been asking that question this week, and over again we find that, yeah, they can do that if you let them. And we're talking about they. You know that mysterious they, the thems out there? Trade, commerce, business, and industry, the big corporation, banks, insurance companies, public officials, policemen. Oftentimes they make demands upon us, and we wonder, gosh, can they do that? They do things, and we wonder, is that legal? Now, if you were trained in legal analysis or in how to do legal research, you could look that up for yourself. And then you'd find out, well, here's where the lines are drawn in the sand, and no, they can't do that. Now, this week I've told you a story or two about this and that and another thing, and here's a story that comes from Anaheim, California, in which one of my students, trained now in legal research, One of the things we need to know in courtroom strategy and procedure when you're preparing a case for trial or when you're out here at the scene of the alleged crime and the policeman is asking you questions, what should you say to the policeman and what should you not say? Do you have to even talk to this guy? You know, there's questions that come up in people's minds. Well, if I don't talk to the policeman, he's going to arrest me and take me to jail. Well, you know, he could pull his gun out and shoot you three times in the chest, too, you know. That's a possibility. It's not very likely, but it certainly could happen. So, if you're timid and you're fearful, and there's a scripture in the Bible that talks about that, you know, the wicked flee when none pursue. And I've observed that over the years, that people who are constantly breaking the law, people who are criminals in their hearts and minds, are fearful and timid people. When I see somebody that's fearful and timid, I say, I wonder what secret sins that fellow is hiding that makes him so fearful and timid, because the righteous are bold as lions. So when you see a guy that stands right up and says, this is where the bear does it, you know, you say to yourself, now that guy, what does he practice? What does he have between his ears that makes him that bold, that confident? So tuck it away in your heart. The wicked flee when none pursue, and the righteous are bold as lions. So you take a guy like Daniel, goes into the lion's den, you know that guy was pretty bold. He knew what he wanted to do, knew how to do it, and knew why he was doing it, and it worked out pretty well for him in the end. Now this fellow's name is Jim. We'll just call him Jim for right now. And Jim lives in Anaheim, California, and he has a business down there with about 30 employees. A big warehouse is what it is. And in this big warehouse, there's a lunchroom, you know, for all of the employees to eat in. Now, I don't know how big the warehouse was in square feet, but semi-trucks backed up, and there's forklifts running around all over the place, and there's goods coming in and goods going out all the time. And this thing, at times, when it's really busy, will run two shifts. So you could have 30 people in here working, you know, in the day shift, and you could have another 30 people working or 20 people working or some number on the swing shift. And Jim mentioned that on some occasions he had actually run the plant or the warehouse 24 hours a day, 6 days a week. They closed one day a week. Now, this particular guy, now, he was a Sabbath keeper, so he closed the plant on Saturday. But it was common to run Sunday through Friday, and it was common to have 30. Now, at the time this event transpired, they were just running one shift, 30 people. And this is a busy place. They've got a lunch room. Now, they've also got an infirmary. They've got a room here with a bed in it, you know, in case somebody gets hurt or paints or something like that, and they need to rest. There's a room here with a bed. Now, there's a kitchen with a microwave. There's sinks, or a sink, so that you could make coffee. There's counter space. There's cupboard space, you know. In other words, it's got everything in there that you would have in your home. You know, it's got bathrooms. In fact, it's got two bathrooms. And it's got more than one stall. Remember, you got 30 people here, and there's a ladies' restroom, and then there's a men's restroom. And so, you know, this is a pretty going up and running operation and business. And so one day, Jim gets into trouble with his wife, and they decide to get divorced. So Jim moves out of his house, and he moves all of his things into the warehouse. And Jim just sleeps in the bed and cooks and does his thing in the kitchen. He goes to the bathroom in the men's bathroom, and he has a shower in there, and there's showers there in the bathroom, you know, for the workmen. And so just like the locker room of a gym, or you know, he's got all the facilities that he needs to live there. And so he does. He just moves in and lives there. And this goes on for quite some time. Now, we should keep in mind that unlike Garden City, where they had not zoned residential out of commercial, in Anaheim, California, they did that. So not only did they zone business out of residential areas, which means that you can't be running your trucking company in Bellwood Estates, but they also zoned residential out of the industrial park so that you could not live here in the industrial park. Can you follow that? This is called zoning and planning. I don't know how you people down in Houston live. They don't have zoning and planning. It's the only major metropolitan city on planet Earth without zoning and planning. Well, that I know of. I mean, they might not have zoning and planning in Pyongyang, North Korea. I don't know that, but Houston doesn't have zoning and planning, but Anaheim, California does. And so when you have zoning and planning, you have to have the zoning and planning police, building inspectors and people like that, that come out to enforce these laws to make civilization work and to make life happy and palatable for all the rest of us. I mean, my God, we couldn't have some guy living in an industrial park, could we? My God, that would threaten the health, safety, and welfare of all the people of Anaheim, California, wouldn't it? Can you imagine the chaos that would occur from somebody living in a warehouse? I hate to think of the criminal behavior that comes from such a person. Well, anyway, this goes on for a while. He had moved in there, and he lived there for a month or two. In fact, I think he said he was there about 6 months. And one day, while he was working in his office and doing his thing, and it's in the middle of the day, and there's all the people driving forklifts and walking around with papers in their hands and doing all the things that people do in a warehouse, a policeman arrived and was ushered into the office, and he asked to see the owner or the manager. And so Jim comes out, and he says, "Yes, what can I do for you?" And he says, "I have a complaint here. And this complaint alleges that there is somebody living here in the warehouse in violation of Anaheim City Council Ordinance Number 22404. And I'm here to investigate this alleged violation of the law." So Jim asked the officer, he said, "Well, who made the complaint? Maybe I could help you a little bit here. Who's complaining about this?" And the officer said, "Oh, I can't tell you that. That's confidential." "Oh. So I can't know who it is that's accusing me or making this complaint. I can't face, confront, and cross-examine my accuser. We just have some anonymous John Doe complaining about bad behavior on somebody's part. We don't know who it is." And so he asked Jim, he said, "Now, who's living here?" So, now, keep in mind now that Jim now has been through school. He's a trained lawyer now. So and he said that back to the officer. He said, "Now, who told you that somebody was living here?" He says, "Well, we got a complaint." And he says, "Well, then what you need to do is to file your complaint with a court of competent jurisdiction, and then we'll come in and answer that complaint." Notice here, Jim didn't say, "No one is living here." He didn't say, "I'm living here." He didn't say, "Joe Sixpack is living here." He said, "File your complaint and let's litigate." Now, the policeman says, now, "We don't have to file a complaint. We can work this out. I'm just here to find out who's living here and to tell you and give you a warning, you know, that this is against the law and you have to stop doing that. And if you'll stop doing that, well, then we don't need to go any further. You know, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you." So Jim came back and he said, "No, sir, you walk in my office and you tell me that somebody's made a complaint and I want to face, confront, and cross-examine that fellow, whoever he may be. And where did he get his information and who told you and so on." And he said, "I don't want to make any admissions or confessions. I'm not here, you know, to incriminate myself or anybody else. File your complaint and we'll answer it." So the policeman left, and that was about all that was said about it. And some time went by, and one day the policeman returned, and then he confronted Jim, and he said, Now we've been watching you, and we know that you're the person who's living here. And he said, for instance, just last week, on the 19th of June, we had your car under surveillance. And you came here at 9 o'clock in the morning, and your car was here all day and all night, and didn't leave the parking lot until 11 o'clock the following day. Jim didn't deny that his car had been there for more than 24 hours in the parking lot, but he asked the policeman a question. Now, I want you to understand something here. The person who is asking the questions is presumed to be the master, and the person who is answering the questions is presumed to be the servant. It's a master-servant relationship. So when the policeman, assuming the role of the master, asked the question or made the statement, how do you explain your car being in the parking lot for 26 hours? Jim responded with a question. He answered the question with a question, and he said, is there some law against me working all night? Now, mull that one over for a minute. Let's think this one through. Let's suppose you're the boss, you're the owner, and you come to work at 9 o'clock in the morning, but at 5 o'clock, when everybody else punches out, you stay there on the job, and you work on the job until 11 o'clock the following morning. Is that against the law? Well, the policeman left, and some time went by, and pretty soon the policeman comes back a third time, and he confronts Jim again. This time he has more evidence. This time he not only has a complaint, he also has reliable witnesses who are prepared to come into court and testify that Jim stays there at the plant all night, many, many nights, and many, many nights in succession. Which now raises the question, well, is it against the law for the owner of the company to work nights? Could this guy have his crew working in the daytime, and then could the owner of the company come in and work at night, you know, kind of like the night shift? You see, boys and girls, the policeman here has a job, and somebody sent him out and said, look, we don't want people living in these warehouses. It's not exactly clear how many people are marauding around the city of Anaheim living in the warehouses, but evidently there's a bunch of them, and then we have to have a police force out here to prevent this criminal behavior. And so the policeman is in here. Notice that the policeman hasn't arrested Jim. He hasn't given him a citation or ticket. He's been back two or three times. He's got now claiming that he's got reliable witnesses, plural, witnesses, not just a witness, not just a complainant. So some time goes by, and the policeman comes back now a fourth time. And he says, now, we've looked all over, and we can't find where you live. So, what's your address? And Jim said, my address is, and he gave him the address of the warehouse. Aha, the policeman said. So you admit then that you are living here in the warehouse? And Jim said, I didn't say I lived here in the warehouse. I said I get my mail here. Let me ask you this. Is it a crime to get your mail at your place of employment? Well, think about it for a minute. What if you lived at 2204 Jones Road, but you received your mail at Post Office Box 1422? Would that be a crime? All right? If we could agree that that wouldn't be a crime, well, then, what if you lived at 2204 Jones Road, but you got your mail at your mother's house, and you picked up your mail there at your mother's house? Would that be a crime? Well, it might be unusual, but I doubt if it'd be a crime. Let's carry it one step further. Let's suppose you live at 2204 Jones Road, but you work at 114 River Drive, and you receive your mail at your place of employment at 114 River Drive. Would that be a crime? You might say, well, that's highly unusual. Okay, let's suppose that it's highly unusual, but that wasn't my question. Is that a crime? Have I done something amiss? Have I damaged anybody? Have I become a threat to the health, safety, and welfare of the public because I receive my mail at my place of employment? Well, I think everybody would agree, no, that might be unusual, but it's not against the law. All right, now, that being the case, notice that Jim here hasn't made any admissions and confessions. He hasn't said, well, gosh, I got divorced and I didn't have any place to go, so I came down here and it didn't make any sense for me to rent an apartment someplace and pay $1,000 a month down the street and then have to commute back and forth to work. So I just moved into the warehouse, and he didn't say any of the above. Now let's get down to the legal definition of live-in or residence here. Because if I bring up the word resident or residence, what comes to your mind? You think of your home, don't you? You think of your home over here at 2204 Jones Road. Or you think of a house, or you think of your apartment or your condominium, don't you? Okay. Now, if you'll go into your driver's license bureau or your DMV and you tell them you want to get a driver's license, and you say, they'll ask you for your address, and you put down Post Office Box 1421. Do you know what they're going to say to you? You can't live in a post office box. We have to have a physical address. And that's because they need your residence. In fact, if you're not a resident of the state, they won't give you a license. At least they won't here in Missouri. It says so right here in the driver's license handbook. It says right here. You have to be a resident. Now, to become a resident, you have to live here for 90 days. So you move from Kansas over here to Missouri, and you rent an apartment, and you live here for 90 days. Then they ask you the question, are you a resident of Missouri? And you say, yes, I am. Are you sure you're a resident? How long have you lived here? I've lived here 91 days. Well, okay, I guess you're a resident. Okay, now we'll give you a license. You tell them, no, I've been here 89 days. No, sirree, Bob, you ain't getting a license today. You come back tomorrow when you've been here 90 days. You're going to have to drive on your Kansas driver's license for another 24 hours because until you're a resident here, by God, you can't get a license here. So they put you in the position of proving that you are a resident because you want this license, don't you? I don't know exactly why you'd want that, but most people do, so they work real hard to show the authorities that they are a resident. So I went to Bouvier's Law Dictionary and I looked up the word domicile, and domicile and resident are synonymous terms. Listen to this. Secondly, all the best definitions agree in making the elements of domicile, residence, and animus menendi. I just want to point that out to you. Now, here's the policeman. He comes up to Jim and he says, now listen, you know, you can't live here in this warehouse because it's against the ordinance, violates the law. Jim hasn't admitted or denied that he's living in the warehouse. He hasn't said. The policeman has staked out the place on numerous occasions and found that Jim's car stays there sometimes for days on end. It just never leaves the parking lot. In addition to that, they find out that Jim doesn't have a residence somewhere else. They've looked all over, and they couldn't find it. Let me ask you this. Let's suppose that you moved in with your brother, Tommy. I mean, you're getting a divorce from your wife. You got to move somewhere. You move in to your brother, Tommy's place, and you're using his spare bedroom. Well, does that mean you're living in your warehouse if you're living in your brother Tommy's spare bedroom? Do you have an address? Do you get your mail down here at your place of employment or in the place of your business? Is that some crime? And then we need to ask the question, what in the hell does the city of Anaheim really care about this? What relevance does it have, you know, to the health, safety, and welfare of the average Joe Sixpack walking up and down the street? Let me ask you people out in Anaheim, California. When this guy Jim was living in his warehouse out there, did that pose some special threat to you? Were you just cowering in your bathroom, terrorized with fear, because this guy Jim is living in his warehouse? Was this public enemy number one? And did you really want to spend your tax dollars hiring some guy to go out there and stake out this parking lot and find out whether Jim is leaving the parking lot at some time within 24 hours and driving to his residence? And I mean, is there ever a time when this police surveillance and this police state atmosphere gets to be enough already? Huh? I mean, obviously we don't have enough regulations and rules and laws, because we have legislatures and we have Congress and we have city councils and county commissioners meeting and making new rules and regulations every day. In fact, in Washington, D.C., we're making rules and regulations and laws at the rate of 47 pages a day. Do you know that? You want to know how many new laws and rules and regulations are coming out of the federal government? Well, it's 47 pages a day, last time I heard. It's probably more than that by now. Now, these 47 pages of laws, rules, and regulations, you know, each and every time somebody enacts some new do this or don't do that, it impacts upon your freedoms. When a law is enacted that says buckle your seatbelt or we're going to throw you in jail, that impairs your liberty to some degree. I know most of you sit out there and say, buckling my seatbelt does not impair my liberty at all. Well, then just leave your seatbelt off a couple of times and see what happens to you. Then come back and report to me, well, what happened when Ranger Rick caught you driving down the street without your seatbelt? Did he stop you? When the policeman comes up to the window, ask him this question, am I free to go? And if he says, yes, you are, step on the gas and leave. That, then, is prima facie evidence that the policeman is not impairing your liberty. I think what the policeman is going to tell you, though, is, no, you're not free to go. I'm investigating a crime. Oh, what's the crime? You're driving without your seatbelt fastened, and you are not free to go. Boys and girls, when somebody tells you you are not free to go, that has impaired your liberty to some degree, has it not? All right, now I wanted to point out here that residence is a matter of intent, in case you didn't know. If you intend to live here in the warehouse, that's your residence. The place where a person lives is presumed to be the place of domicile until facts establish the contrary. So the policeman presumes that this is his place of residence or domicile until facts prove the contrary. But the policeman has the burden of proof. I mean, after all, he's the one that's complaining. So the burden of going forward is on the policeman to come in and allege that he's living there. And then, two, that's his residence. Mere taking up residence is not sufficient unless there is an intention to abandon a former domicile. Nor is it even prima facie evidence of domicile when the nature of the residence either is inconsistent with or rebuts the presumption of the existence of a animus menendi, or domicile. A subsequent intent may be grafted on a temporary residence. Removal to a place with an intention of remaining there for an indefinite period and as a place of fixed present domicile constitutes domicile, through or though there be a floating intention to return. Proof of domicile does not depend upon any particular fact, but upon whether all the facts and circumstances taken together establish the fact. And engaging in business and voting in a particular place are evidence of domicile there. And the law favors the presumption of a continuance of domicile. And the original domicile continues till it is fairly changed for another. So when you've got a domicile or you've got a residence, we presume that it's there until you change it. And that's why the policeman, when you go to get your driver's license, asks you, are you a resident of Missouri? Have you moved from Kansas? Do you intend to stay here in Missouri? Now, what if you lived here in Missouri? Let's take the French ambassador from France. He's been in New York attending the United Nations for 11 years. Is he a resident of New York City? He's been there 11 years. He's got a house there. Well, the answer is no, he's not a resident of New York City. And there's a case in here that talks about a guy that moved from Scotland to Sri Lanka, called Ceylon in times past. I think they call it Sri Lanka today. And anyway, he lived there for 28 years and died there. And so a question arose, well, was he a resident of Scotland or a resident of Sri Lanka? He was an English citizen. He's a Scotsman. He's a British citizen. And because of these kinds of events that come up, the legal definition of a resident has to be established by facts. Now, in this particular case, the Scotsman said he never intended to return to Scotland. He spoke deridingly of it or in derision and said it rains all the time and it's a nasty place and I'll never go back again. I'm here where I belong. Even though he's an English citizen, after he died, his estate was settled under the laws of Sri Lanka, not under the laws of Scotland. That's because he had changed his residence. He wasn't a citizen of Sri Lanka. So residence, then, is a matter of fact. Now, another man moved from England, and he moved to Spain. Lived there for 12 years and died. Question arose, was he a resident of Spain or was he a resident of England? The answer was, he's a resident of England because he always intended to return to England. The reason that he didn't is because he had tuberculosis and he couldn't live there until he recovered his health. Another man did the same thing, lived in Baltimore, Maryland, and moved to England. He died in England. The question arose, is he an English resident or is he a resident of Baltimore? And the answer is, he's a resident of Baltimore because he always intended to return to Baltimore, even though he had lived in England for 17 years. That's where he died. So if Jim here does not intend to move his residence into that warehouse, he's not a resident of the warehouse. But in almost every case, all of the evidence that is ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And so the policeman comes out and starts asking you questions. And as soon as you say, yes, I've taken up residence here in the warehouse, you are guilty of violating the ordinance and you then have to pay the penalty. Jim never paid a penalty. He never moved out of the warehouse, never established residence there, never violated the ordinance. It appeared like he was violating the ordinance, but his residence was never in the warehouse because he never intended to make the warehouse his residence. And that's the definition of a resident. It's your intention, not the fact of living there. It's your intention to live there. Just thought I'd pass that one on to you. Hey, we're at the halfway point here, and I got to remind you that you are listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on Compact Disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we're endorsing and recommending are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about can they do that? In almost every case, it's, well, they can do that if you let them or if you don't know any better. Oftentimes, ignorance gets people into trouble, and they don't even know what it is. They're just trying to be honest and helpful. And then when the policeman comes, they just open their mouths, and they just can't shut up. They just can't stop. You need to understand that the policeman has a job to do, and his job is to gather evidence. And so he wants to get you to talking, and the more you talk and the more notes that he can take, he can then better determine how guilty you are. He's not there asking you these questions because he believes you're innocent or that there's no wrongdoing. The reason he's asking these questions is because he has been sent here, he has been instructed. He believes that there's wrongdoing, and he's gathering evidence to use against you. He does not have to read you a Miranda warning on a non-jailable offense. So, many times people ask me, well, but he didn't give me my Miranda warning. He doesn't need to if he doesn't intend to use the evidence that he's gathering as testimonial or parole evidence in trial. How do you like that? So, you know, he can ask you for your name, address, and telephone number and all of that, and you give it to him freely, don't you? He's going to use all of that against you. Well, but in the average Joe Sixpack, you know, he doesn't see that his name, address, and phone number, and his social security number, and where does he live, and is he married, and does he have children, and is he working, and where does he work, and how much money does he make? He doesn't see that as being used as evidence against him. You wait until you go in here to a child custody case, or you go in here to a custody hearing or a child support hearing or something like that, and find out how much you make or where you live and how important that is. So it doesn't make any difference what the issue is, whether it's are you living here in the warehouse, or are you a resident here, or did you murder that guy laying on the ground over there. All of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And oftentimes, people are convicted of crimes based upon evidence that came out of their mouths, which was, in their view, totally innocuous and totally innocent, which later came back to bite them in the butt. So I thought I'd pass that one on to you. Here's an example of how that can happen. Have you ever watched Perry Mason or watched some of these courtroom dramas? And they bring the defendant in and they read these charges against him. And how do you plead? You know, the judge is very stern. He says, and how do you plead to these charges? Well, we all know how to plead. I mean, you know, we've all watched television. We all know it's, listen up now, that we all know that we say, not guilty, Your Honor. Right? You all got that down pat now, haven't you? You know how to do that. Well, good for you. Now, let me explain something here. The minute that you plead not guilty, your chances of being convicted from that point on are 94%. Got that? 94%. Now, if you plead guilty, your chances of being convicted go up dramatically to 100%. So if you walk in and plead guilty, you have a 100% chance of conviction. And if you plead not guilty, then you have a 94% chance of conviction. Now, those are not very good odds, boys and girls. I'd like to kind of move those odds up to at least 50-50, where I don't know if I'm going to be convicted or not, but at least I got an even chance. How would you like to move the odds up to 90% of the time I win and I'm exonerated, and 10% of the time I'm found guilty? That'd be even better, wouldn't it? All right. So just remember this. The minute you plead not guilty, for all practical purposes, from that point on, you can not win. It's impossible. Well, I say impossible. Not quite. You know, you got 6 percentage points there. But for practical purposes, the minute you plead not guilty, that's all over. You might as well have pled guilty and saved everybody a lot of time, effort, and energy, because in the end, we're going to find you guilty anyway. Bottom line. And the reason for that is an obscure term. See if you can write this one down. You've probably never heard of this. If you're a lawyer, write this down. You've probably never heard of it either. It's called pleading into a fiction of law. Pleading into a fiction of law. And the system is set up so that when you walk into the courtroom, you are automatically trained from a child up to plead into this thing called a fiction of law from which you cannot win. Isn't that just special? Now, I'll give you a quick illustration of that. You see, in law, you have to be right 100% of the time. Unlike college, where you only have to be right 70% of the time to pass. In law, you have to be right or correct 100% of the time to be exonerated. I know the odds go way up, but that's the way the game is played. I don't make the rules. I'm just pointing it out to you. So if you can get 96%, you're going to get an A. You know, if you get an 88%, you're going to get a B. But in law, when you get a 96 or an 88, you flunk, you lose, go to jail, don't pass go, and don't collect $200. Now, that's the way the game's played. So you have to score. You have to ace the test every single time when you're dealing with the judiciary. You know, I'll give you an illustration. You got 2,000 traffic laws, and you're out speeding one day. And you come into court and say, well, but judge, I was obeying 1,999 laws. And you're just bitching about this one. And that's what the judge is going to say. That's right. See, you have to practice all 2,000 all the time. And we're only going to prosecute you for the one that you're in violation of. We're not going to prosecute you for the other 1,999. We're not mad at you about those 1,999 at all, just this one. That's the one we're going to get you with. So you see, when you sign up with that driver's license, you have to practice all 2,000 of those traffic statutes perfectly all the time. Never fail. First time you fail, policeman sees you, he got you. All right. Now let's take a little excursion here. Let's suppose that we're all sitting here in my office, here in the classroom, and an MP comes in. So you just view this, you know, picture this in your mind. We're all sitting around the table here, and I'm over here talking, and in the door comes a military policeman, an MP. He walks in the door, and he said, I'm looking for George Gordon. Now, I raise my hand, and I say, I'm George Gordon. And he says, well, Sergeant Gordon, I have a warrant here for your arrest, and you're under arrest, and the charge is that you're absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington. All right, now let's analyze this for a second. How many George Gordons are there? Well, I don't know, but I'll bet you that there's more than one George Gordon here in the United States. And it could be that there is a Sergeant George Gordon who is absent without leave, but the fact that my name is George Gordon and I just raised my hand and said, I'm George Gordon, I just volunteered, didn't I? I mean, when the guy walked in the door, he says, I'm looking for Sergeant George Gordon. If everybody had shut up and never said anything, if we didn't have a Judas in here who is going to come over and kiss me to identify me, this guy would have to pick, let's see, which one out of you six people am I going to take today? Let's try it another way. What if he said, okay, I'm going to search all of you people in here, and none of us had any identification on him. None of us are carrying our papers. Now what's he going to do? So you can see right here that the policeman really needs somebody to confess to something. See? So now I stuck my foot in my mouth, and I confessed to being George Gordon. I never confessed to being Sergeant George Gordon or the George Gordon who's absent without leave. And I'm not even here to argue that there might not be a person named George Gordon who is a sergeant from Fort Lewis, Washington, who is in fact absent without leave. But is this the place for me to make my defense? Is this the place for me to say, oh, I'm not Sergeant George Gordon. I'm the other George Gordon. I'm one of the others. There's more than one of us here. See? All right, so the policeman now, he arrests me. This is the MP. And where is he going to take me? Is he going to take me into Springfield? We're all sitting here, you know, around the table in Isabella, Missouri. Is he going to take me into the grand jury, maybe in Springfield? Maybe he's going to take me to the federal judge, you know, Judge Clark up in Springfield, or where do you think we're going? Well, you know, if I got this scoped out right, I think we're going to get in his car or his Jeep or his airplane, and we're going to go right straight out to Fort Lewis, Washington, where they're going to throw me in the brig, I think. And so, but now I'm going to ask all of you people out there, can you see how preposterous this is? And here's this guy arresting me, calling me Sergeant George Gordon. Well, let's analyze his complaint. He said, I'm looking for Sergeant George Gordon who is absent from Fort Lewis and doesn't have permission to be here. All right, now let's take a look at George Gordon. Is he absent? And is he absent from Fort Lewis, Washington? And does he have anybody's permission from Fort Lewis, Washington to be in Isabella, Missouri today? Well, let me ask all of the rest of you people out there. If somebody charged you with being absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington, wherever you are in the world today, are you in fact absent from Fort Lewis, Washington? Well, where in the hell are you right now? You know, if you're sitting in Mexico City, aren't you absent from Fort Lewis, Washington? You know, if you're in Bangkok, Thailand, aren't you absent from Fort Lewis, Washington? Because here in Isabella, Missouri, you know, you can just look at me and see, yep, this guy is absent from Fort Lewis, Washington. I'm also absent from Fort McClellan and Fort Dodge, and I'm absent from Washington, D.C., and I'm absent from Houston, Texas. Can you see that? All right. Question is, well, is that a crime for me to be absent from Houston, Texas, or Fort Lewis, Washington? Well, if I was a Sergeant George Gordon, that might be. If I didn't have a Liberty card, it might be. If I didn't have Colonel Johnson's permission to be here, it might be. So there's one question of fact here that you don't know, so I'm going to confess to this. Do I have a Liberty card? And the answer is no, I don't. I do not have a Liberty card. So here I am, George Gordon in Isabella, Missouri, absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington. So I meet all of the factual criteria, don't I? And after all, that's what the MP is looking for. Now he hauls me back to Fort Lewis, Washington. Now I'm going to be brought up before the provost marshal. Now this is the military judge, and he's going to say to me, well, now, Sergeant Gordon, how do you plead to this absent without leave trip? Guilty or not guilty? Now, if I plead guilty, I can be convicted 100% of the time. If I plead not guilty, I can be convicted 94% of the time. So if I want to be exonerated, how do I plead? And the answer is, I don't. This isn't the place for me to plead. If, in fact, my defense is, but I'm a civilian, I'm not even a soldier in the Army. Because, you see, the minute you plead not guilty, you have admitted to being a soldier in the Army. Because you never raised the question of, are you or are you not a soldier? And the question, how do you plead guilty or not guilty, translated into English so that you people can understand it, says, how do you want to move forward? When you plead not guilty, you say, Judge, I want to move forward by agreeing with the prosecutor that this is a factual question as to whether or not I'm absent with or without leave. No legal issue at all. In order for you to raise a legal issue, you would have to demur to the charge. Demur. You ever heard that word? Now, I know you lawyers are all sitting out there saying, but, you can't demur. Demurs have been abolished. Well, okay. Well, then how about a motion to amend the complaint? Let's try that one. Huh? So, let's try answering the complaint in writing with a challenge to the jurisdiction of the court. Could we do that? And could we motion up a subpoena deuces tecum to compel the prosecution to bring in the enlistment contract? Huh? You think maybe we could do that? You know, if we were in a civil rights case, you know, we'd file a B6 motion to dismiss. Now, wouldn't we, boys? Force the other side to come in here and prove they got a cause of action? Don't you think that when you're charged with a criminal act that you should prove, that you should force the other side to prove that they've got jurisdiction? Now, I know a lot of you patriots out there, you say, well, I challenge the jurisdiction of the court. I've heard people say that for years and years. Well, I challenge the jurisdiction of the court. See, they walk in, I challenge the jurisdiction of the court. That is not a challenge to the jurisdiction of the court. And that's because every court has the power or the capacity to determine whether it has the capacity to move forward. And the burden when you're challenging jurisdiction falls on you. What evidence do you have that this court doesn't have jurisdiction? Burden's on you to prove it. And mouthing off, this court doesn't have jurisdiction, is an allegation. There isn't any proof in that. That doesn't prove anything. Judge, your hair is blonde. So what? Judge, your eyes are blue. What's that prove? I challenge the jurisdiction of the court. So where is that going to get you? Now, you know, when you're brought before the court and they ask you the question, how do you want to move forward? They use different words. They say, well, how do you plead? Well, I plead not guilty. Okay. That's what the judge wants to hear. Music to his ears. Got you now. You're dead in the water. They do this in tax cases all the time. I watch guys come in there, and I saw a guy one time. He's on the witness stand, and he said, I'm not a taxpayer. The prosecutor jumped up and screamed. He said, objection! It goes beyond the scope of the pleadings. And the judge gave a curative instruction, and he said, now, Mr. Jones, that statement goes beyond the scope of the pleadings. We're not here to decide whether or not you're a taxpayer. We're here to decide whether or not you filed your tax return. Now, think about that. You know, by the time you get up on the witness stand and say, I'm not a taxpayer, and you're charged with willful failure to file, we're not here to decide whether or not you're a taxpayer. That's already been admitted. That's a fiction that you pled into when you pled not guilty. You admitted to being a taxpayer. Only taxpayers plead not guilty. You know, if I was a non-taxpayer, I wouldn't plead not guilty. Let me give you an illustration of that. In Stewart versus Chinese Chamber of Commerce, cited at 168 Fed 2nd, 709. You got that down? Stewart, S-T-U-A-R-T, versus Chinese Chamber of Commerce. Goes back to about 1920-something. Phoenix, Arizona. Cited at 168 Fed 2nd, early on in the Federal Reporter, page 709. Now go to page 712. Just jot that down, page 712. Listen to this. It says the revenue laws are a code or system in regulation of tax assessment and collection. They, the revenue laws, relate to taxpayers and not to non-taxpayers. Did you know that there's a guy out there called a non-taxpayer? No procedure is prescribed for non-taxpayers, and no attempt is made to annul any of their rights and remedies in due course of law. With them, Congress does not assume to deal, and they are neither of the subject nor of the object of the revenue laws. Non-taxpayers aren't being hassled by the IRS. I'm a non-taxpayer. I've been a non-taxpayer for about 25 years. I used to be a taxpayer. When I was a taxpayer, I was hassled by the IRS constantly. I had 3 audits. But when I became a non-taxpayer, then the IRS didn't take cognizance of me anymore. They don't assume to deal with non-taxpayers. I just thought I'd point that out to you. Now, let's suppose that, for some reason, the IRS policeman comes in and he says, all right, Gordon, you didn't file your taxes last year. Hell, that's not an issue. I didn't file any tax return last year or the year before that. So when he charges me with willful failure to file, the last thing I'm going to do is walk in there and plead not guilty. That would admit that I'm a taxpayer. I'm going to walk in and plead non-assumpsit by way of confession and avoidance in a written answer. And then I'm going to file a subpoena deuces tecum and say, what evidence do you have, Mr. Policeman, that I'm a taxpayer? Who told you that? Let me face, confront, and cross-examine that dude. Bring him in here. Let's get after him. That's why we call this a fiction of law. Can they do that? Well, they do it every day. Why, people are being convicted day in and day out. They walk right into court, and the judge asks them right up front, how do you plead? And they say, I plead not guilty. And they get right proud of it, too. They'll come back and they'll say, well, I told that judge a thing or two. Well, I stood right up there and I pled not guilty. Yes, sir. Yes, sir, you did. They got you now. You're dead. You saved everybody a lot of trouble, you know, if you'd have just got up there and pled not guilty and got this thing over with. They'll give you a lighter sentence, too, because it takes so much less time, effort, and energy to sentence you than it does to convict you. Now they got to spend some time and actually convict you, but you're not gonna be exonerated. Well, not 94% of the time. And if it's a tax case in the Fifth Circuit, it's 98. Your chances of winning a tax case down in Texas is 2%. Not impossible, but boy, you're getting down to where it's almost easier to win the lottery than it is to win a court case in the Fifth Circuit on a tax charge in Dallas, Texas, now, I'll tell you. Now, if you could come in there, assuming that you're innocent. Now, most of you people out there are taxpayers, and most of you are guilty as hell. I have people, they come in here, and they say, well, look what they're doing to me, and I'm innocent. They actually believe they're innocent, but they're not. They're guilty. They're taxpayers. And they haven't filed their tax returns, and they haven't paid their taxes, and they're actually guilty. Once in a while, though, you'll find some guy that's actually innocent. Then he goes in, throws his defense away by pleading not guilty, pleading into a fiction of law, and losing his case. And then he says, can they do that? All right, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.